This is Jesus Shalom, a podcast about peace, spirituality, values, and activism from a Jesus-centered, world-embracing, shalom perspective. I'm Tim Peebles. On this podcast, we sometimes interview folks to talk about their faith journey. Other times, we talk about their shalom activism. Today, we have a bit of both in my conversation with Joe Kidd, whose shalom activism is expressed in a life of vegan, organic, no-till farming. Before we get to that, however, the conversation begins with some of her faith journey. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So let's start with how you would introduce yourself. Tell me a little bit about yourself. How do you introduce yourself to others?
Well, it depends really who I'm speaking to. So in lots of different ways. I probably say I'm a veganic farmer. I'd say I'm a mother. I would say that I'm an earth and probably earthling activist. I might say I'm an eco-feminist. A green anarchist is also, it depends if you want a label really, but yeah, that's what you're kind of thinking about. I would increasingly say that I'm a Christian animist.
Okay. A lot of provocative titles in there. Maybe we can talk exactly. through some of those. I like to ask my guests about their backgrounds, their faith backgrounds, religious backgrounds.
Yeah, sure. Well, I didn't have a religious upbringing at all. Apart from perhaps a couple of times at Sunday school, colouring pictures of, Jesus and stuff at school, really. So, yeah, my family weren't religious. But I always had a very deep connection, deep feeling that I was connected with other, with nature, within nature, really. And kind of from a very young age, can always remember having a very deep empathy with nature and with other animals. So, yeah. I think as children, we kind of, as we grow up, we kind of move away from the spirit world, if you like. I always think the children are much closer to the spirit world. And now I can look back, I think, that I definitely was. And I know I can remember I used to pray. So where that came from, I can't really remember, but I always prayed in my bedroom. So, yeah, I didn't have, we didn't go to church. I was christened, but that was just what people did, really. it was just a traditional thing. So, yeah, I think as I kind of grew up, I grew increasingly atheist, really, through my childhood and teenage years, and increasingly angry at the world, and really moving away from the spirit, I suppose, in kind of wondering, looking at the horror around me. And, as you grow up, you start to see these things more, you're less shielded, and maybe start to question we didn't have the conversation around God, but how can there be a greater being, or control, who's controlling all this? So yeah, increasingly angry and alienated, and like many people really, and suffering with some depression, and kind of self-medicating as I got a bit older. And I think probably that, that eventually something has to give, doesn't it? So, eventually you get, I always describe it as feeling as if I'd kind of gone to the dark side and there was almost, it had to be, that was it, or there's some way you come back from this. And most people's stories, there's lots of different things that happen, you can't necessarily pinpoint one thing, but I sure. remember my friend, after a particularly, depressing, all the way through this, I was functioning and doing things, practically doing things, work, projects, traveling, but still there's that psychologically, just not happy person. And I remember a Christian friend, particularly depressing and kind of experience, and maybe tonight, just try praying. What have you got to lose? And because I was so kind of, it's just a load of rubbish beforehand. But really deep down, I think I realised. And I did that night. I prayed, and that was it. Really, those feelings went almost immediately.
Oh, wow.
And I kind of literally saw the light, I think, you know, and it was fear, really. You know, I had that real fear from being that close to being so miserable. Hmm. And that went, and I wasn't scared anymore. Hmm. And that's when I kind of knew, you know, and all these other feelings, I think, came back, and realizations, actually, that's where I've come from. That's how I used to feel.
Hmm. You mentioned some anger. Was that related to was there a sense that the stuff that you connected to in nature and animals and so forth, that was your anger related to that, that you perceived that as under threat somehow, or an inability to connect with that more? Or was it just, you know, the course of life as life happens to us?
I think, it was the feeling that people didn't care, and other humans didn't care enough, probably. Mm. As a child, that was the feeling. Why is no one else feeling as outraged about this, these things that are going on? Mm-hmm. How can they not be doing anything about it? You know, all those childish, but actually very wise ways of thinking, as we know now, aren't they? But we treat children as if they're just naive and immature and don't really understand. But it was seeing things, seeing cruelty, becoming vegetarian, working that out. That was on my plate, was actually an animal, and I love animals and I really feel very connected. So why would I be eating them? My friends. But why is everyone else not doing it? You know, all sorts, really, I suppose. And then seeing things on the news, seeing humans. I mean, it's just all suffering. Mm. Why is that happening? And why are people not angry about it? And how can I be? And then you get the whole thing with teenage, you know, that quite natural, really, with anger and hormones and everything else. But probably I probably felt pressure to maybe not fit in, because I never really did. But to be happy, maybe not. Why am I kind of the only person worrying about this? So that's where I think the self-medication comes in, to be to actually remove yourself from that constant turmoil in your head. You know, mm-hmm. what can I do about this? You know, I'm just one person. And I think, you know, once I started to realize that actually I can do things, even if it's not completely changed the whole world overnight, I can do things. And by going vegan, that was a huge weight lifted. Although when I went vegetarian, I felt at the time that was enough, because I didn't know anything about the dairy industry or, you know, what else happens to animals in that's not directly meat, you know. Mm-hmm. But once I did understand that, and then I went vegan, it was a real weight lifted. So I think doing as much as I possibly could helped.
But
also realizing that is who I am, rather than thinking I need to be someone else. I need to be this happy person who can go to a party and not be just wanting, you know. Really, I should have just gone walking on my own and hung out with the trees, and I would have been fine. But that isn't how society works, is it? So there's lots of pressures.
It's not. Identity questions are one of the... We describe ourselves in Jesus Shalom as Jesus-centered and world-embracing. And one of the realities of contemporary life that we're trying to embrace, to be positively engaged with, are the kinds of identity questions that we think are just more pervasive in our environment than maybe they were even in our parents' generation, and certainly beyond that. So much of life once was given, and you kind of knew who you were and what you were supposed to do, and that was given with the circumstances of your birth. And it's probably been several generations of that breaking down, but at this point in time, that has pretty thoroughly eroded, so much so that it's almost required that we not be what we were given at birth, right? Be all that you can be, choose your happiness, find your own way. I mean, all of this is sort of part of the cultural assumption now. And so identity becomes something that we all have to wrestle with.
Mm. Yeah, is that an assumption for everyone? Is that...
Well, probably not. I wrestle with my own identity questions and find myself wondering sometimes whether there's a significant class component to that, my identity journey is very much tied up with educational attainment. And with that education has come a change in my class circumstances. I grew up working class and went to first in my family to go to university, then to go on to graduate school. I just have lots of educational attainment that is not part of my family of origin. And with that has come a significant shift in my class sensibilities. So there's times that I wonder whether all this identity stuff is a comfortable middle-class question, that working-class people like my dad never wrestled with this question, that he knew. He knew that he was to use his body to earn an income to support his family. And there would be questions about how to do that or where to do that, but that this was going to be his vocation in life was just sort of assumed. I don't know that it was something he wrestled with. But at the same time, it does seem to me that we are in a cultural environment where media and educational institutions, all of this is sort of sending us this message that we have to kind of find our own way. And if you feel like your sense of who you are is dissonant with that dominant order, that can lead to real real challenges, it seems to me. Lots of loneliness, a kind of bewilderment of where do I fit in? Where do I belong? Yeah, so I hear some of that in your story.
Yeah. I think you know, it seems to me that young people are seem much more aware. Certainly it's difficult to know when you're kind of surrounded by, not necessarily on purpose, but you're surrounded by people who tend to agree with you or tend to be in your, on your same wavelength. So it's difficult then to know how someone in a, very kind of poor kind of working class background would feel. Are they having those kind of same messages when they go to school or, around them in the family? But even I think, mass media kind of stuff that people is coming across on TV and in social media does seem to be a lot more awareness around that. It's, being yourself and it's good to be different. And, we do see that a lot. So I do feel very hopeful. And certainly with young people, just seems so much more with it, really. Their language generally is just so much more with it. Get what's going on. And that kind of inclusive language, it's just, don't even think about it, certainly for my generation, it was kind of, I suppose, just the transition between that, before it was, 50s, 60s, 70s was all kind of very, sexist and racist, and that was the language, and again, even on television, it was just assumed, and then through the 80s, lots of things started shifting in the 90s, and we were kind of wrestling with that. Almost feels like that. I don't know if you've seen the film Carnage with the comedian Simon Amstel, and he projects into the future, 50 years into the future, and it's a vegan world, and all the people who are much older, my age, your age, a part of that middle aged up, are going to therapy, they're having group therapy because they came from that world where it wasn't vegan. Whereas all the young people, it's just assumed, this is how it is. And so it's that kind of thing, isn't it? That, we've gone through that and we're still maybe put our foot in it or get the wrong, say the wrong word. Whereas young people I speak to, under 20s kind of thing, just get it. They just feel it. It's just in their DNA. And it's so positive and exciting.
They've come up with a shift in worldview and shift in language, and so it's more native to them than it is to us. It feels like ill-fitting clothes to us in some ways.
Sometimes, it feels very exciting. I mean, it's always going to be the way, isn't it? We generate. That's the whole point. I always say to my daughter Rosa, if you didn't know more than me, if you weren't wiser than me, then it's pointless. We're going backwards. That's all we need. We need young people to know more than the older people, and don't ever think just because someone's older or they say they're your teacher that they necessarily know more.
Yeah.
That isn't always the case.
So you had this person who said, why don't you try praying? And I take it that that has then led you on a journey so that you're now involved in some kind of church situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, right. I do. I mean, when we can go to church, I do go to church. We're in a village. I mean, we're living on a farm, so we're in a village, and we've been in and out of kind of rural life really for the last 20 years, I suppose. So I'm back where I should have been when I was a child. I should have been in the countryside. And so the village church, yeah, how many years ago? 15 years ago or something, I suppose. Just felt a calling. I was walking past with my little dog, and there was a sign, I think, and it said church open, everyone welcome. And I thought, yeah, I bet that's not really, you know, because I had all these not preconceptions, but I'd grown up, you know, being told that Christians were hypocrites. Christians weren't really, you know, it was all just something you do on a Sunday. It's not really real. And obviously there's, you know, a lot of that is true, but so I had a, you know, but I just still felt that I wanted to go into this place. I felt something was calling me, and I walked in, and as soon as I walked in, I felt just so welcomed. Emotional about it again. It was just so lovely. The people were so friendly and happy to see me, and didn't even care that, you know, I just thought they won't want a dog in here, you know, they'll definitely be speciesist. So but they were lovely. And ever since, it's such a lovely congregation. And I know, I'm sure other places aren't necessarily as friendly and welcoming, but I was lucky. But it turned those things, you know, on their head. And because it's just lovely to be part of that village community, really, and the congregation are so welcoming and open to different ideas, I still go and I'm still involved. And I've got involved in Eco Church, and I've got involved in other things, you know, through the Church of England. But as you know, and we've discussed in our Christian Animist Hub, the liturgy and the readings and, you know, the language doesn't sing with me. It doesn't it doesn't make sense. I can't cope with the patriarchal constant, you know, everything's he and father, and the speciesist language as well. So I change that in my own head in church. And that when I do prayers, when I lead intercessions, I make them it's very inclusive language. But I can't see that shifting very quickly within the church.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you never know. I mean, it's not been that, it's only quite recent that women have been able to become ordained. So things do change. But I still, yeah, I enjoy that. I enjoy that connection with people, I think. But there's something more that I need and get from other places in a spiritual way.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds like there's a mix of, I mean, it's relational connection, but it's relational connection in the environment of, what shall we call it, like Christian symbols and scripture and the language of faith. It's there, has its edges, its ambiguities for you, but it also does articulate in some ways your spiritual sensibilities.
Yeah, I think the fact that the people, you know, we shouldn't judge, but the vast majority of the people who are there for the same reason. They want to connect with God, and they want a personal relationship with God. And they really, you know, we want to be better people. We want to be kinder. We want to be more like Jesus. So I can see that in people. And, you know, and our vicar's lovely. She's very, very inclusive and open and easygoing and, you know, not all the kind of formalities and the them and us thing at all. So yeah, it's really, it really does give me a spiritual lift in connecting with those people in that way. And just such, you know, amounts of kindness, really. People care about what we're doing here on the farm, and, you know, people are interested in each other. And so, yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to come back to the farm in a moment, but I'm just curious. You said that you grew up in a environment where you were christened but didn't participate in church, became atheist, and now you're in a church environment. But through that earlier phase in your life, you had a kind of spiritual sensibility. You had a kind of sense of connection with nature and things like that. When you came to church, did it did it provide a language for making sense of that spirituality, that spiritual connection that you already had? Or do they exist sort of in parallel? You have that whole spiritual part of your life and way you talk about it, and then there's this churchy part of life.
I think it was less the spoken language in church and more the feeling and emotion and feeling of connection with people who want to try and do the same thing, even though probably on lots of other levels the people who are there are not on the same wavelength, in a way, you know. We're the only vegan family. We're a lot younger than most of the people who go. We're probably politically, I imagine, different to quite a few of the people, but not certainly not all of them. So yeah, it's not, it's just that feeling that, you know, actually there's a group of people, and obviously then that kind of widened out and out as I really started to realise there's a group of people who really do believe and really have this strong faith and really care, you know, and they can't all be mad, really. It's that kind of feeling. So, yeah, not so much the language. I don't know. I mean, certain things as we go through the liturgy and hymns, certainly singing. I mean, that's really been missed through this COVID for so many people. You know, I can see how sad people are because they're not allowed to sing, not able to sing.
Yeah.
But that really is very uplifting. And I found, you know, on my very early kind of experiences in church, that I felt that's something different, almost, you know, like a high, like a spiritual high that lifts you right up, and again feels like you're resonating with everybody else in that building or that place, wherever it is.
And it sounds like even though your fellow congregants don't necessarily share your values or life practices, that they've also not pushed you out because of those. They've made space for that in their own life together. You haven't been rejected because of that or booted out or anything. So you've been received as you are with the values you have, which is a good thing.
Yeah, which is Christian, isn't it? That's the whole point, you know, and that learning those lessons, you know, really for someone who, did just think increasingly that the religion was the opium of the masses. That was, you know, I was a Marxist, and I probably would still call myself a Marxist, but as well, that's another label you can add. But yeah, just realizing that actually that is what it means, is about acceptance and grace and forgiveness, and, you know, there's greater than the sum of the parts, isn't it? That's kind of understanding, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into some of those labels a little bit. I'm curious how you came to them. You know, you can choose not to answer them, or we can move on if you like. But I think the place I'd like to start is tell us a bit about your farm, because that's a expression of some parts of your identity, right? Tell us about your farm, your business. What do you do with it?
So we have a veganic agroforestry farm. It's a small farm. It's just under 6 hectares. And as you know, we're going to be relocating over the next year, so to somewhere slightly bigger, but not much. But it's plenty big enough for us. And that's myself and my partner and our daughter and the 3 furry friends, and lots of other people who help all the time, community of, you know, helpers. And so veganic is, for people who don't know, is vegan organic. It puts those two words together. So it goes beyond organic farming. A lot of organic, or most large scale organic farming particularly, will use animal products. So byproducts from the slaughterhouse, things like manure and bone meal and fish meal and blood meal. And also organic farming allows a certain amount of chemical use as well, synthetic chemical use. So veganic farming doesn't use any animal products at all. Obviously no farmed animals, no exploited animals. There are plenty of animals involved, but they're all self-determined animals who want to be here. So
part of the natural process of your environment. The
wildlife, exactly. And we encourage, you know, the way we farm encourages those other animals to be here even more. And we, so yeah, no animal products, no, you know, animal manure. It's all done basically through, well, a lot of the organic farmers rotate. What we're trying to do is not crop rotate. We're trying to use just perennials, or the majority perennials. So using agroforestry, which is planting crops with trees, growing crops with trees, and the interaction between the crops and the trees is what makes it exciting and what adds value, really. And then, yeah, growing other perennials, so you're not digging, you're not tilling. But also we are doing some cereal. We weren't going to be doing some cereal, but a local sourdough bakehouse asked us to. They were interested in us growing some heritage wheat for them, so we did. And I was determined to do it in a way that wasn't tilling, so not disturbing the soil, because obviously, you know, that destroys the structure, that destroys the organisms in the soil. It's best, you know, if you can kind of replicate a woodland, really, a mid-succession woodland, that's kind of like the optimum way to grow. So, yeah, so anyway, with the cereals, we're trialling a no-till approach, which means that you then use green manures. So you grow your cereal, and then just before harvest, you're sowing, oversow some green manure, maybe clover, or depending on the soil structure, different types of nitrogen-fixing crops or plants. And then you harvest, and then those green manures come up through, and then you just mow off, and then you sow back in, or you sow back in and then you mow off, rather. So it's a continuous, it's a Japanese pioneer, really. Well, I think probably indigenous people have been doing this kind of thing for a long, long time, for, you know, millennia. But it was a Masanobu Fukuyoka, it's not very easy to say his name for me, but a Japanese man who kind of brought this to the fore, really, with his book One Straw Revolution. And he was growing rice, and he was, you know, seeing all the kind of paddy fields and how everything was being intensively farmed, and there were flooding every year, and the soil was really just becoming more and more depleted. And so, yeah, he used this approach where he just, it's called continuous cropping, so you don't rotate and you don't bother the soil, you know, you're just building soil, basically.
Interesting.
So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do lots of different things, really, because we're quite new. We've only been here since 2018, so we're new to farming. Although Comrade is his background's agricultural engineering, which is rather helpful. So anything machine wise, he can sort out or build or fix. And I'm really getting into the planting side. So yeah, so we're just trying lots of different ways of doing things, really.
Why did you get into this? Was it you just wanted to live off the grid and support your own family? Or, I mean, it is a business as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So although we're not making huge amounts of money yet, but that's the plan. Yeah. No one makes any money.
So how did you decide to move?
Well, being vegan, we were vegan for 20 odd years. We've been vegan, and I think lots of things, you know, we've kind of both been environmentalists for a long time, well, all our lives, really. I'm very interested in that kind of way of living, low impact living, off grid, doing things in a way that, you know, we're in harmony with nature rather than fighting and controlling, trying to control nature. So this was the next logical step, really, was thinking, actually, we're vegan, but we also want to be able to grow our own food, but not have to rely on too much imported. I haven't got an issue with importing food as long as it's done fairly, but the fact that we can grow so much here, you know, reducing that carbon footprint, those air miles, and showing people, really, it's about showing other people as we learn together how we can grow and live in harmony with nature. So looking at what other things we can grow, things that we can grow, building materials, you know, and clothing, and bringing back flax, we'd like to try that here. Was all across the southeast were linseed fields, and that's all kind of happening in northern France and the Netherlands now. So obviously reasons for that, economies of scale and everything else, but it would be good to be able to bring that kind of thing back. And hemp, you know, all the things you can make and build with hemp. So yeah, we just like to kind of do things in that low impact way, just showing that you can live successfully in harmony with nature, and we can feed everybody. That's the idea.
So it's largely value driven, it sounds like. that this is a way of embodying the values that have been important to you. And we do have practical necessities. We have to make ends meet. And so the business side of that is a way of both spreading those values and raising funds for practicalities.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
Yeah, it's kind of all of our principles and all the projects that we've been involved with before. I kind of think this is kind of like a culmination of all those things in one place. Mm. Being able to, you know, live. I mean, we're staying here. We haven't got a guarantee of being able to live here. It's 5 years that we're allowed to stay because we've got permitted development. So it's all quite a challenge. All those kinds of things, being able to live if you haven't inherited land, if you're not a big landowner and you haven't inherited, it's big issues around land reform that's needed, and you know, new people and young people being able to get into growing and farming. Mm. It's virtually impossible. So and I call us young, you know, we're not even young really, but you know, much younger people, it's very, very difficult. In the southeast of England, even more than anywhere else, there's huge pressures on the land for development, and the prices are mad. So
With regard to the business side of things, is your business mostly a local business, or I don't know the language of farming. So I know that farmers markets and things like that have been familiar to us back home in Chicago. Is that how your business sort of operates, or tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, we're learning the language of farming. It's a steep learning curve, but we're aiming to be really, I suppose, East Kent. We're in near Faversham, so kind of a radius of 20 miles really is what we aim for. We're selling our wheat and potentially other cereals when we do them to the bakehouse, which is a mile and a half away.
Okay.
And then another baker who's about 4 miles away. And then we've got a local farm shop and village stores where we've sold some of our veg, because we've done some annual veg because we're going to have to move. We had to do some annual planting. And then the plan when we move is to have perhaps a small honesty box or a little kind of farm shop of our own. And then the idea was to sell to the local vegan cafes and shops and restaurants. And there's a lot in East Kent.
Oh, okay.
And there were a lot. So it's which ones of those are able to survive through this craziness, really. But we're well connected with those because we've kind of set up and run the vegan Kent Vegan Market and Kent Vegan Festival. And so in kind of East Kent, we're well connected with the vegan community. So that was the idea, was selling to those people locally. Hmm. And then some local people just in the village as well. But we're not going to do veg boxes. I think a lot of people have warned us against veg boxes, a lot of work. And
is what you're doing part of any kind of network of other people doing similar things in their local environments?
There are quite a few different, cross-cutting networks, really. I mean, there's a lot more people becoming interested in agroforestry, particularly, and agroecology. So that farming, growing in harmony with nature rather than all about inputs and chemicals and controlling nature. You know, there's a huge surge, really. Not as huge as the vegan surge, but I see those curves. You know, the vegans kind of, veganism has gone like this, and the agroecology and veganic farming is kind of following along. But there's the Vegan Organic Network, which is veganic growers and farmers. So we're part of that, we're connected in with that. And then there's things like the Oxford Real Farming Conference, which was happening last week, which was 10 days, I think it was, online conference. But that happens every year, and is people interested in agroecology and, you know, indigenous land rights and all those kinds of things, really. Once you get started, you start to kind of hook up with people and you realize how many other people are trying to do this kind of thing. I haven't really met anyone doing exactly what we're trying to do here, but everything has to be dependent on local conditions, really. Mm-hmm. So I don't know anyone who's kind of doing the veganic and agroforestry and the no-till and the off-grid and the no plastic all together, but there will be, but not necessarily in this country.
Mm,
But there's a global network, yeah, a veganic global network. So it's exciting times, really.
Well, I would think that for we've been vegan for a while now, and you know, there's just a bunch of vegan products that are marketed online and shipped around the world. And it just struck me that your model is very much a local one, wanting to engage your local community and share your resources there, because that actually reduces carbon footprint and things of that sort. So,
and pollution, plastic, all those things, and showing that we can grow. Okay, we can't necessarily be tropical, not yet. Maybe we're getting there, but we can grow things with that high, you know, with high calorific value and high protein and nuts. You know, we're very excited about nuts here. We've put in lots of nut trees, and that's what we're going to carry on doing, nuts and top fruit, but particularly nuts, because you can grow a lot more in terms of calories and, you know, energy that we need and protein on a smaller scale. But also, if you're growing trees, you're growing up, and you've got the layers, you know, so you're also growing horizontally, so you maximize that space, really.
Interesting.
And the trees interact with the crops and provide shelter and, you know, wind breaks, and they reduce moisture loss and prevent soil erosion and create habitats. So all those interactions, just really trying to replicate a mid-succession woodland, doing it in different ways, different patterns of doing that, food forests and alley cropping and, you know, all sorts of different approaches.
This podcast is brought to you by Anvil Trust, a charity that articulates, advocates, and advances Jesus Shalom in every sphere and domain of life, personal, social, political, ecological. To do this, we offer spiritually and theologically informed faith journeys through interpersonal accompaniment, facilitated conversations, and group presentations. If you'd like to connect with us in any of these ways, information will be provided at the end of the show and in the show notes. For now, back to our conversation.
You know, we use the language of shalom a lot, a Hebrew word, and one of the components of shalom is relationship, that everything is related to one another. And I suppose it's possible that everything could be related and then at odds with one another, which wouldn't be beautiful. But the shalom vision is everything is related, and that relationship is integrated, enriching, diverse, coordinated. And I just hear a lot of that in the account you give of how you farm and how you imagine engaging with your partners there, the partners of the trees and the earth and all the things in between. Have you used this language of shalom before encountering Noel? I'm not sure when you met Noel. Maybe that would be a place to start. Tell me.
I've kind of lost a year, like most people have, but I think it was 2019. So it wasn't last year. I think it was the year before. Yeah, quite recently. Yeah, May. I know it was May, and it was a workshop that Kasama, you know, Kasama Emma, and do you know Emma and Glenn Morton? Mm-hmm. They'd organised down in near Battle, near Hastings, and it was through a friend, actually a local forager, or quite well-known forager, Miles Irving, had sent, he knew him. Noel, you know Miles, yeah. He knew Noel, he'd met Noel a few times, I think they'd done some things together, and he then told my friend, and then she saw it and said, oh, Joe would love this, you know, this workshop, it was a retreat, actually, it was a weekend retreat, talking about Christian animism, and I read it, and then I contacted Noel, and we had a lovely, you know, as everyone does with Noel, you know, a lovely conversation, very uplifting and inspiring and welcoming. Anyway, I signed up to go to the retreat, and it was lovely. It was really refreshing, and lovely people there who were, you know, exploring this in different ways, but had quite a lot in common in terms of wanting to find a different way to express and engage with this, you know, with the spirit. and, you know, weren't satisfied with the kind of the traditional liturgies, if you like, or traditional religious paths. So, yeah, so that's how I met Noel. I hadn't met him before then, no. But we'd had conversations, so it felt like I had. By the time I met him, it felt like I knew him very well.
Mm-hmm. So it was in that gathering that you were first encountered some of this language of shalom and all of that. Well, when you heard it, did it speak to some of those early spiritual intuitions and longings that you had?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, you guessed it. Yeah, it was just like another light going on, you know. Oh, wow, this is exactly how I felt, how I feel, but how I felt when I was a lot younger, and there was no way of being able to express that, or no kind of channel for that then, or outlet. It felt right at the time, but then, you gradually learn and move away from those things. So it was, like coming back to the child within, almost, but in a positive way.
Lovely.
Yeah, and... everything he said, really. And just the openness of that conversation, being able to just, you know, ask questions and know that other people would probably be feeling the same, or just felt very inclusive and kind of equal group of people. So,
yeah.
And Shalom, when he explained his Shalom journey and how that's brought him to where he is to talk about Christian animism, and how that, you know, was a kind of epiphany in his faith journey, just made so much sense. It was just like, all these things that I'd kind of, you know, was battling with or asking questions of in church, you know, how can Jesus be the Son of God? That how can Jesus be divine when, you know, go into great detail, but you know, in terms of time and how if he was eating animals or he had to be vegan, and all those questions just suddenly became, it just makes sense, you know. And the kind of feeling that I had of being Indigenous, or wanting to be Indigenous, wanting, you know, that we all need to be getting back to that state of living in harmony with the earth.
Yeah.
And understanding and breathing with the earth as one, not just, you know, acknowledging that we're all nature. That all came out of that discussion. Thank God.
A coming home of some sort.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What about the Jesus side of that? I noticed you sort of went there and then kind of pulled back a little bit. we tend to talk in terms of those two poles, the shalom orientation, the vision and values of shalom, but centered on Jesus in some ways. That's the unique offering that we feel like we have to offer the world. That there's lots of other people who talk about Jesus and maybe some justice and things connected to that. And there's a whole different other group of people that talk about shalom, justice, integration, creation care, all that kind of stuff. But it's often the case that those two groups don't come together, and we'd kind of like to see them more interacting. So I think for many of our listeners and many of our community, the Jesus-centered part of that is maybe the harder part to wrestle with, because we only encounter Jesus through the church and how the church has talked about him and all the theology about Jesus and things. So how do you grapple with those things? I sense a little bit of grappling going on, as you referred to Jesus a moment ago.
Yeah, still some grappling, less than previously, I think. I think you hit the nail on the head, really. It's what is kind of trying to move away from all those images and all that language that's become embedded. And you know, it's very difficult of having heard even you know, not going to church, but school assemblies and all those places where you hear the patriarchal language and the image of how the Trinity and Jesus and in a way that isn't, I don't know, that fits, I suppose, fits more of a human need to control rather than that real, that deep spiritual shalom, you know, oneness, wholeness. We are all connected, and everything we do has an impact. So that's, I think, where the grappling comes. I think if I hadn't had that in my earlier years, it would be less difficult to grapple, because with the way, you know, again, the way Noel explains how Jesus was trying to teach us, and what, you know, about being indigenous, that Jesus was really, I don't know if Noel actually says this, but was a shaman in a way, you know, it's that kind of different way of looking at Jesus, and how he was saying, I think, all the things that probably have been written out of history, but how he was telling us that we can be like him. That's the message. And that was, in a way, when that clicked, that whole question about Jesus as the Son of God. I still struggle with that, Jesus being the only Son of God, to be honest with you, very honest. I can't say that I think that is the case. I think we all are sons and daughters of God, but Noel helped me by, you know, kind of understanding that a bit more, because he said Jesus is basically teaching us how we can be like him. We can be divine. We have it within us. That's the whole point. We are all connected, because, you know, as well, this kind of brings all the scientific stuff into it. People think it's the faith and science can't mix. But that early on in my 30s, someone introduced me to John Polkinghorne.
He's one of my favorites.
Oh yeah. And she was my therapist. I was having therapy. So I was coming out of that dark side. And, she introduced me, and that was another kind of, I'd always thought you have to be one or the other. You know, you're either a believer, and so you're probably a little bit mad, or you're a scientist, and there's nothing, you know, no way those two things can mix. But obviously John Polkinghorne talks about that, you know, about the soul and about cells, cell regeneration and quantum physics. And Noel was introducing that as well. So again, that all started to make more sense. And I just remember feeling more at peace with that.
That's nice.
That kind of the liminal space, if you like, between the science and the faith. I've always imagined that two things will kind of, eventually that's what will happen, they'll meet. And then everyone will go, that's God. Now it makes sense. There's God. I can picture this in the future.
You know, you said something a moment ago that has me thinking. You know, you contrasted the church's accounts of Jesus, which kind of foster a sort of control kind of mindset. You contrasted that with a shalom vision that sees us as connected to other things, and in that connection is a sort of dependence, an interdependence. We can't do it on our own. We don't have full control over that. Or when we try to exercise that full control, it has bad consequences for the creation and for ourselves. That's just an interesting and insightful to me observation that, you know, shalom, Jesus shalom, as we talk about it, is not one more way to get cognitive control of our environment. It's not some new theological vision that we're going to use to cultivate another kind of spiritual technology that gives us mastery of our environment or something like that. It's a vision and values that encourage interdependence, bewilderment in the literal sense of being in the wilderness, embracing that, embracing wonder. So anyway, it just struck me that you made that contrast. I think that's really insightful and really important for our contemporary environment, where so much of the way we're formed is back again to being autonomous individuals, so not connected to everything, and in control of this little space that we occupy, in a way that means we're solely responsible for it. And this is just horribly corrosive to human well-being. It it cuts off our embeddedness in all sorts of things that are life-giving to us. It makes us responsible for things that in many cases are imposed on us by systems that are harmful to us. And so an alternative is along the lines of what you've suggested, one where there's a kind of interdependence that loses some control, embraces some wildness. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing it. I'm wondering if there are other ways that this, you know, now that you've encountered this Jesus Shalom vision, are there ways that you think about it in your ongoing work as a farmer, as a parent, as a church person? How does it inform your life currently?
In everything I do, really, I think is the answer to that. It's either there very strongly or it's there in the background. But when I'm working on the farm, you know, connecting with the soil and the plants and the out there in the open, that it's, I find it much easier. It's very easy to feel that connection with the rest of life and with God and with the rest of the universe, you know, and with the big skies and the stars and all the rest. Again, coming back to how I felt as a child, looking up there and wondering and, you know, just feeling at peace. So that's easy. But even when I'm not outside and I'm maybe working or, you know, I'm doing things with Rosa or, yeah, it's just a constant reminder, really, that's what we do to ourselves, you know, we do to others, and that it'll have some kind of repercussion, and let's try and make that a positive one, but also relaxing into that rather than feeling, as you were saying just now, constant pressure to be, you know, putting pressure on ourselves, really, to be the best and to never make a mistake and to never be angry or never say the wrong thing, because again, that's another, you know, self-medication is not perfect. We're not perfect. We're not quite as we want to be. We're not saying the right thing all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I think gradually that's, you know, I've felt that I can relax into that as I've got older and discovered these different ways and different people and different language, without getting too much into the politics. But I think being challenged by elites, you know, with the potential to control, to divide and rule, to set people against each other, it becomes even more challenging to show that there's a different way and that we don't need to be blaming each other for something that's out of our control. And actually, let's just, you know, find the kindness. And I've seen that so much over the last year, really.
I think I hear some of your Marxism coming through.
Really? Marxism. I was reading Chomsky again. I haven't read any Chomsky for a while, but the other night, and just reminding me that you, from his point of view, you have to be a socialist before you can be an anarchist, you know. So all anarchists, I think he says something like all anarchists are socialists, but not all socialists are anarchists, or, you know, I think it's that way around.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and I was kind of thinking about my own political journey as well, and how that's all, as far as I'm concerned, connected. I mean, Jesus was an anarchist. And I remember my mum telling me, you know, saying that Jesus was an anarchist, so you don't need to go to church, you know. So there was there.
I mean, coming back to that,
actually, it was there, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, she was very, probably still is, anti-organized religion. Maybe less so these days, but she had some good points. And I still think that's it. Jesus was an anarchist. And
yeah. Well, it's sometimes easy to take our Shalom talk and drift off into the clouds with it and think it solves all our problems. But I'm aware that it also has a bit of an edge. It sometimes raises questions, challenges. And so I'm curious, are there places where you've heard this Jesus Shalom vision? You think it kind of speaks to some of your prior life experience? It captures the values that are important to you. But does it have questions? Does it raise questions for you that you'd like to go deeper into, or challenges that you don't quite know what to do with? We're a learning community. We don't we're not interested in producing one more theology to replace others and be settled, but rather theology more as a trajectory or as a flexible framework that we can continue wrestling with life challenges within it. So I'm curious if you have some of those.
Always plenty of questions, just generally, I think, in life. I think that's when we have to give up and we stop questioning. But I suppose, particularly with thinking about, you know, shalom in terms of relationship and the fact that we're all connected and we're all person and we're all nurtured, and, you know, then a big question would be, that means that they, you know, that kind of, I'm not sure how to put this really exactly. Well, I suppose in nature, in where, you know, kind of we see in nature, we still see some cruelty in human beings. If we see cruelty, I feel like I can explain that away fairly, not away, but I can explain that a bit more easily, in that, you know, the person committing that might have had been neglected, you know, experienced cruelty themselves. I might answer this in my own question. I've just realised, you know, that people are damaged, stuff happens, you know, within society where we, you know, we put pressure on each other and ourselves. So you can kind of explain that a bit. But in the natural world, when we see cruelty, not just animals eating other animals, but actual cruelty, you know, torture and things that aren't in harmony with each other, that I struggle with that. Where does that come from? You know, how does that fit with the shalom? The universe wants to be in balance and is trying to reach that equilibrium, and it, you know, something that happens here affects something else that happens over here. Then, yeah, I suppose where do kind of those carnivores and those animals who, and you see particularly in the invertebrate world, real cruel, looks like to us, maybe that's the thing. It's again a human centered perspective, but yeah. So I struggle with that. That's a bit.
I mean, it might not be cruelty in the human sense, but it does seem to be something other than just killing in order to eat.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I think of the David Attenborough video I saw some years ago of the orca sort of tossing a seal around.
That's what I was picturing as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Unforgettable image. And I remember him saying that we don't really know why this is happening. It's not just for food. Perhaps it's a kind of play, but it's a kind of play that imposes suffering. So yeah, I share that question. I wish I had a clearer answer to it. What about on the other side? What about dreams, hopes and dreams? When you think about Jesus-centered shalom life as a farmer, what kind of things do you dream about for yourself, for your community, for the wider world?
I dream of a veganic world, a world where everyone is living in harmony, is, you know, truly connected with the earth, is acknowledging, is appreciating that we're part of nature, separate to nature, not above nature, not needing to control nature. So yeah, a dream where, well, it's Garden of Eden, I suppose, isn't it? Obviously
sounds but a bit yeah, like that.
Yeah, where we're, you know, we're all happy, and yeah, that's my dream, really. That's my those. And I can see that coming, to be honest with you. I know, maybe wanted to talk more about the question side, but actually I can see that coming. I do feel very hopeful. And the way things have shifted even in the last 10 years, really. And just the hope that I have in young people, like I was saying earlier, really, the kind of intelligence and wisdom and just the kind of egalitarian way young people behave and are. So I have a lot of hope.
Mm-hmm.
for that world. I think it's a really lovely quote, the Indian woman, Arundhati Roy, isn't it? Mm. I'm trying to remember what she said. Something like, another world is not only possible. She is here, or something like that. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. Mm. I always think that quote's so perfect. And that's it. And I think we experienced that again with the first, particularly with the first lockdown. That's how it felt to me. I just kind of went outside, and we're not busy in a busy place here, but you still have cars and the motorway we can hear from a distance and planes, you know, and I just, actually, I can't hear any of that stuff. And you could really, really feel the earth just going, taking a breath, you know, and actually, this is how it could be. This is what it could be like.
Mm. I've wondered sometimes whether what we need to learn to do as folks trying to care for the more than human environment that we share is to stop doing anything, to just step back and let it be, and that it will heal itself. It will find its own way. And we can then participate in those currents. But it's not up to us to create those currents or to fix anything, but largely just to restrain ourselves, redirect our own engagement in some way. I think David Attenborough actually says something like that at the end of his most recent video movie on Netflix, I think it was. He says,
"Who is that? Sorry,
David Attenborough again." I think.
Okay. Yeah.
I think he finishes by saying, "Nature will come back if we just sort of get out of the way and restrain ourselves better."
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that we have to disappear either. I think that's the whole point of what we're trying to do here. You know,
we can be participants.
Yeah, we can be in there. We can be participants. We can observe as well, and we can learn. And that's again what Fukuoka, the farmer I mentioned, the Japanese farmer, his approach to farming. He called it something like no work farming, or something like that, which was basically you are doing. I mean, he was doing things, and he had lots of people around him, students and people to kind of help. But it wasn't lots of effort. He was just trying things. He was, you know, scattering seed and see what grows and what's happy in that particular plot. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. And, you know, not forcing it with chemicals or ploughing it a bit harder or pulling out all the weeds, you know, but just going with the flow, really. And that's
I've never heard of this person. This is interesting. I'm going to look him up.
One Straw Revolution. If you read, I mean, he wrote another book, and I can't remember the name, which gives more detail about his actual method. But One Straw Revolution is quite a philosophical read, really, a spiritual read.
I'll look him up and put some information about that in the show notes so people can follow up with if they'd like. Is there anything that you'd like to talk further about that we haven't touched on?
I don't think so. I think we've covered, what have we covered? Spirituality, religion, politics. Done well.
Yeah.
I think we're good.
Many thanks to Jo Kidd for taking the time to talk with me about her faith journey and her work as an organic, vegan, no-till farmer. And a special thanks to Sarah Baker, who composed and recorded the original music you've heard throughout this episode. And thank you for listening to our conversation about Shalom. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please share this with your friends, review us in iTunes, and visit our website at jesus-shalom.org, where you can leave questions, comments, and suggestions, and also sign up for our mailing list. If you'd like to connect with the wider work of Anvil Trust, you can visit us at anvil.org.uk and join our newsletter list there. That's all for now. Deep shalom to each of you. Okay.
Yeah.
Are there ways that people can connect with your work?
Yeah, here on the farm, and we have... Yeah, I didn't mention those other projects as well, but We have a couple of other projects that we're involved with. But on the farm, we're Tree of Life Veganics. So we're on Facebook and Instagram as Tree of Life Veganics, which, again, that was a kind of discussion with a wider community about naming the farm. And Noel helped very much in that discussion. And yeah, because I kept talking about the Tree of Life, and he said, "I think you've talked about the Tree of Life. Maybe you should just call it the Tree of Life." And so, yeah, Tree of Life Veganics. But we're also involved in a project called the Abbott's Mill Project, which is another environmental and social justice project in Canterbury, where we want to build a peace centre. And but that would be, we would basically reinstate a water wheel where there was a mill that burnt down in the 30s. We'd put a water wheel there and use that to generate electricity and educate people about microgeneration. And then connect that with the Peace Centre, so the Peace Centre is completely run on renewable energy. And really,
what's the vision for the Peace Centre itself?
It's really around connecting people with ways to live in harmony. So shalom, we could even call it a shalom centre. But yeah, ways to live in low impact, easy kind of suggestions. It's in the middle of Canterbury, so it's in the middle of a city. So a lot of these kinds of places are in quite rural, remote areas, and we wanted it to be very visible, so people could come and see how can you actually live differently within a town in ways that had less impact or have more positive impact on your natural environment. So nice. There'll be information in there, be kind of displays. That's the idea ultimately. It's a big long-term project, and we've been working on it for a long time already. So but we're getting there. We're going to be doing some bank softening work this year. And
who's the we involved? Are these collaborators with you or friends?
Well, it's me and Comrade, mainly me and my partner. Comrade. And and then we've got lots of other partners. With the city council are very supportive, the environment agency, the county council, the universities, the other kind of wildlife and conservation organizations locally. So and lots of volunteers get involved. So